Finding a hoodie that lasts through the season can be tough. The American Giant Classic Full Zip Hoodie is made to last year after year. Snag the hoodie that brings comfort for life. Save 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20 at checkout.
It's The Wonky Show, live from Nijmegen in the Netherlands. We're back in Erasmus. We'll get across that. Student loans are under scrutiny. And all we've seen on our study tour of the Rhineland. It's all coming up.
I think it's interesting because sometimes you hear the thing, students don't know what they want. I've heard that a lot, actually. And actually, I think that's wrong, because if they really are that thick, we really shouldn't be in the position that we are in the league tables. And our academic staff isn't that good.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Dickinson, and here to celebrate their freedom of movement, as usual, three brilliant guests. Abby Taylor is president of Durham Students' Union. Abby, your highlight of the week, please.
I'm a bit of a in-the-moment kind of person, so I was going to say the Smirnoff Ice in front of me. However, probably the library in Luxembourg blew my actual mind. If anyone's been to Durham Students' Union, it's my least favourite form of brutalism. I despise it. Don't tell them that. Gary, my CEO, is here, but I don't like it, and he knows I don't like it, so I'm not going to look him in the eye. But they have done brutalism well, so well done, Luxembourg. It was beautiful. My jaw was dropped the whole time. I would live there, I think. It was very good.
Gary Hughes is chief exec at Durham Students' Union. Gary, your highlight of the week, please.
Thanks, Jim. Other than, obviously, following Abby around, holding her things, my highlight of the week has been the Agora. We'll speak about it later, but it's a real example seeing student solidarity and the way that people are addressing things. All long heritage, brilliant things in France. I'll tell you more about that later.
More to come on that. And Matt Marshall is Wonky's Community and Policy Officer. Matt, your highlight of the week, please.
My highlight of the week, Jim, is when I met Lennox, who was this fantastic leader in a student union in Zurich. Lennox was a dog, but a very cute dog, nevertheless.
So yes, we start this week with Erasmus. Matt, just before Christmas, the news broke that we'll be spaffing $500 million on middle-class jollies. Is there more to it than that?
There's always more to it than that, Jim. We got an early Christmas present. The UK government have announced that we're rejoining Erasmus Plus. I feel like the plus is important. But it's never that simple. You know, we're still not clear on loads of different bits and bobs. We're not clear on the fee arrangements. You know, we don't know whether EU students are going to pay domestic fees, whether that 15% fee cap for UK students studying abroad will continue. There's a few schools of thoughts, though, on Erasmus Plus. You know, is it a middle-class holiday? You know, there's $500 million that are going to be flowing to HE right now, or, you know, soon, when students are seeing little other than non-loan money go towards them. Higher socioeconomic students always do stuff like this without barrier, and it's always those students with, you know, those compounding disadvantages, like BAME students and care leavers, that never seem to see the benefits. And there's a real question here about whether there is even a national, you know, proper strategy behind Erasmus Plus, how things like credit transfer are going to work, you know, how this intersects with access and participation. And then just this week, the European HE sector have called on all of EU institutions to allocate at least $60 billion for Erasmus in the 2028 to 2034 budget cycle. There were 17 organisations behind that proposal. They've said that, you know, the current plans are around €40 billion will barely maintain current activity. They say that, you know, this is one of Europe's most cost-effective instruments, and that if we want to deliver long-term results in skills, employability, innovation and civic engagement, that this underinvestment will undermine the EU's own political objectives.
Now, Gary, I would love to think that this is all about, you know, ministers and the Department for Education really caring about UK student mobility. This is really about softening us up for freedom of movement and cozying up to the EU, isn't it?
Well, for a change, let give Bridget the benefit of the doubt for just a moment. There will be lovely soft benefits to this. Like the challenge we felt over the past couple of years around how we feel connected to a wider world, about how we take the benefits of exchanges to culture, about how the quality of higher education in the UK is affected by our ability to enter into research partnerships, access research funding, collaborate across Europe. Let's assume Bridget is doing this for brilliant educational reasons and there will be a good side to it, because there will be. Mm. We'll talk about a degree to that, I'm sure. But you're absolutely right that the volatility of the international sphere, you know, this is a podcast about higher education, but nothing exists in a vacuum, and the world is a little bit crackers. And it will doubtless be the case that the government will be looking to build economic partnerships as the unpredictable economic environment is only going to continue to get more unpredictable. Free movement has been little r ruled out, but so have lots of things, haven't they, over the rules. And then we move back to it and rule it in. But I think on balance, I would would give the government the benefit of the doubt for now and look forward to actually being able to welcome people in and encourage students to go out.
Yeah, they've been really pleased. Every time we've mentioned it, they've been really pleased, haven't they, Abby? But part of that, presumably, is because when we left, a shed ton more of European students came to the UK than UK students went to Europe. Do you reckon that will change? Do you reckon students are queuing up to leave the UK for a semester? Because I've got a feeling I would. I'd quite like to, but then I'm in the middle of Nachmanen. I would say that, wouldn't I?
It's an interesting one. I mean, I think that UK students are in general grabbing any extra opportunity that their university gives them with both hands, because the grad market, particularly in the UK, is so dire at the moment. Yeah. I also think that studying abroad is extremely expensive in a lot of cases, and this is maybe a slightly more cost-effective way to do it from a student perspective. I mean, I love Europe. I would have loved the opportunity to do it. It's rather frustrating that I've graduated and they've decided to ramp it back up. It is a weird one. I remember when I saw the news story for the first time, it wasn't necessarily what I'd expected the government to make decisions on around higher education when we've been kind of crying out for so many other things for such a long time. But I'm not going to say no to a European exchange in any form. And I think that anything that makes UK students more competitive in the grad market is a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, Abby's right. It does feel a bit lopsided, this MAC. You know, on the one hand, we're having to pay for some scraps of maintenance grants worth 10 peanuts to three subject areas by the end of the parliament through taxing the eyes out of international students. But on the one hand, we're spending well over $500 million on this.
There's two sides to this for me. There is the positive, as Abby says, that, you know, students will be more employable. We know all the benefits in terms of, you know, continuation, in terms of student outcomes, in terms of, you know, developing oneself by travelling and studying abroad. I wonder whether, and Jim, we've been speaking about this a lot when we've been visiting all these different associations in Europe, that we have one of the fastest, you know, degree programs in the world, in Europe. We graduate students far too quickly. It damages their health. It damages their mental health. And they've got no time to do anything that makes them employable. I wonder whether Erasmus won't just be an opportunity for students to, you know, have a bit of fun and experiment in a different country, but also a way to slow down their degree. A conscious choice which might not be automatically built into some of their programs, but now it gives them the opportunity to slow down. And as people have been saying over the past couple of days, have the time to be a student again. But the opposite side of this, the other side of the coin, is exactly that. It's the optics. We have got student union leaders on our bus crying out, talking about maintenance loans, about the high cost of rent, about the high cost of living. Yeah. And, you know, what was it? It's been spent...
Hundreds of millions.
It's been spent on this programme. At the same time that students are making, you know, the classic decisions around heating or eating, and we've just normalised that. I think the optics of this is incredibly worrying, plus the differential outcomes that will come from those students that can afford to do this easily and will have the confidence to, versus those that will never have understood it and will never have an opportunity to.
Mm. I mean, the costs thing is really interesting, isn't it, Gary? Because wherever we have been this week, you know, there is a student accommodation crisis right across Europe. Mm. And quite often people have sort of said to us, oh my God, we're having to pay X for rent, and every single time it's nowhere near close to the UK, is it?
No, I mean, I think I
suspect that more than one thing is true at once, as ever in the world of policy. I mean, it's hard to disagree with what Max said, of course it is. But I also think thinking about the longer term is the job of the policy people. And I think that it is possible to address some of the immediate needs around housing and around maintenance and fossil living. And also think about things like the ability to create research collaborations. You know, one thing that particularly interests me about the benefits of this is that our vice chancellor at Durham, Professor Ryan, has written about the crisis in modern languages education. And actually the way in which our universities are really withering in modern languages and in international cultural appreciation.
Yeah.
And this is part of that, I think. Mm-hmm. So I think what I lament is the broader higher education strategy that we are promised and the way in which all these things can be tied together in a grand division for HE. I think I will continue to lament that for quite a while, but I you may not be optimistic about this. I think Mac isn't wrong, but I think it's a rare good news story, isn't it? It's rare.
Absolutely. Yeah, we'll take it. We'll take what we can get.
Mm. Tell you what, Abby, right? One of the things I found really interesting is, as I remember Erasmus, it was a kind of, not saying a kind of niche thing, right? But it always felt very, if you would like to, if you fancy it, blah, blah, blah. There was never a sense, certainly when I was looking at it, I don't mean as a student, Sweden. I mean, you know, I mean, that was a long time ago. So anyway, in Iceland, that it was seen by UK higher education as just a genuinely really good thing to do. And of course, we've seen degree programs this week where a mobility semester is
standard.
Compulsory in some cases. Yeah.
So, and also, I mean, we've seen across the sector and, you know, sabbatical officers who are having to see university budgets being stripped back. I think if there's something that's coming from central government that they can access and the universities are just going to push it regardless of whether they think it is niche or whether they think it is valuable. And yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think it's one of those things where you don't really know what you've got till it's gone. And I wonder with Erasmus whether no one really thought we were ever going to leave the EU, and then we did. And actually, this, I wonder whether at the time we just kind of thought it would always be there and we could always use it. And I think now we know that we didn't. Like, my degree didn't have that. Actually, a new set of students coming in might go, yeah. And I think universities will go, yeah, as well.
Now, Matt, this thing about, because the European Students' Union is upset, the European University Association is upset. And what, just run us through again what they're upset about.
These 17 organisations which have argued that the Commission's proposed 40.8 billion investment is not going to match inflation, and it's not going to match these new responsibilities. And I think they're particularly thinking about this from an access point of view, that those different underrepresented minority groups that have got this kind of compounding disadvantage are not going to be able to go on these programmes, use the scheme to its full potential if it isn't invested to its full potential. It's not going to play out properly, and it's always going to be one of those schemes which is for those middle class students with, you know, parents and people that can support them and can go on and get, you know, fantastic careers. It's only going to make that awarding gap and that graduate outcome gap even bigger.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, any opportunity that's first come first served can kind of suffer from that. But I mean, the other thing that strikes me, Gary, is it's not your grandma's Erasmus, is it? There's loads of other things in it now.
No, I mean, I think if I just can come on Max's point, I think we've got to bear in mind that since we left Erasmus, the architecture of access and mobility has changed in UK universities. So actually, the APP agenda and actually what we think about in terms of graduate outcomes and the quality of the student experience, we now have different tools, we have different expectations, and I'm really hopeful that people who are lower family income and particularly students of colour are able to benefit from the Erasmus scheme, because universities have different ways to motivate and incentivize that.
Yeah.
My fear is actually it will be in certain sorts of universities.
Mm-hmm.
So Durham will absolutely be able to use we're very proud of our grant framework. We can accelerate those students. Yeah. I really worry about universities we don't have the resource to accelerate working class feedback. But as I say,
but that's quite interesting, because you'd assume that Erasmus would find its way into access and participation planning now.
I would really hope so.
Yeah.
So I think the challenge for student unions and I suppose international offices and PVCs for international, as well as for I hope modern language departments or people with more international outlooks, is to make that case that actually it can't be about a gilding of the lilies, not a recruitment offer, like it's essential to education. This is an educational thing, not a jolly.
Cool.
You're back to weaving the point. And certainly I think at Durham, we will be speaking to our university about it's not just that we have it, it's how we have it.
Mm.
And actually, if it is going to go to people who are going to go to Europe anyway,
yeah,
what is the point?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, this is meant to be an educational advantage for people who would not otherwise get it. But to your Erasmus Plus point, I think that the scheme that we need to recognise has gone, that actually the ability for people to spend a few months, a few weeks, a semester in places is going to be different. Mac has made the point around funding that we're still unclear about actually how fees will be paid both ways. We're unclear about the way in which credit can be earned either way. So I think there might be a reflection that DfE is very good recently in the past year at going progressive outcome. Everyone goes, oh, should I be excited? Like, you might be. We'll tell you soon. Yeah. So I'm a bit worried about what the next, what was it John Fee said? It's not the disappointment. It's like, I hope I can do with it. It's disappointment or some such thing. Yeah. So broader, I think, Jim, we need to see the devil. Like, it's the detail that will ruin this. And if at all. So I think our job when we go back to campus is going to have to be to carefully scrutinise this, but also play a full role in it.
Mm. I guess the other thing, Abby, right, is, you know, I mean, we have come across lots of things this week which are very similar, but we've come across lots of things that are very different. And one of the things I wonder is when people come back from their kind of Erasmus experience, are they mainly thinking about the lovely cobbled streets and the things they ate? Or is there a potential that people start to think about how courses are laid out, how, you know, assessment works? You know, doubtless later we'll talk about the fact that everyone that we've met in Belgium is orally assessed. You know, I mean, presumably on one level or another, there's an opportunity to sort of, you know, pick up some interesting intel about how higher education is working, quite often on lower budgets, I might add, than it is in the UK.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think something we're not very good at in the UK is evolving our general teaching and assessment practice, particularly at Durham. I mean, they try really hard to be accessible, but I think we have a very set way of doing things and it's been quite similar for a lot of years. I'm sure that's the case for a lot of UK universities. I also think you think that you're the standard, and that's what something that's been really helpful on this trip is you go, well, of course, this is how we do exams, or this is how we have feedback from students. And yeah, it's blown my mind slightly. I mean, yeah, I'd love an oral exam. I think that sounds brilliant. And I think for different people whose brains work in different ways, like the potential to offer a range of assessments is really interesting. And actually, I'd love students to come back to the UK and be a bit irritated that things are a certain way, because I think we are always, as student unions, desperate for students who are really enthusiastic about shaping and changing their academic courses. And actually, it's a very small minority of students who want to talk about the quality of their course. They just want to get through. They want to get to the other end. They want to get their degree. If we could have students who were thinking, like, it would really make a tangible difference for me to lobby for this change, that would be really healthy for our unions, because we'd have more active people. And also, I don't know, I think that it's interesting in general the way that students seem to have to be maybe a bit more vocal than British students in general on the way that their universities are run. It seems to be a lot like they seem very empowered to be bold and honest. And I think that maybe if you were in that for even a couple of months, you'd come back and go, oh, maybe the MEQs I'm getting at the end of my module where I write a couple of comments isn't enough. And I think that would be refreshing, because I suppose we've been out of this for a while. And if the previous demographic was students who were probably a bit privileged, were used to a university sector that works for them, written exams and pretty like just standard. If we had a more diverse range of people who were going on these trips and coming back, I just wonder whether it might energise some of our academic frameworks. You'd hope so, maybe.
But it's interesting Abby says that, Matt, because, you know, I don't know about you, right, but, you know, you kind of arrive in another country, and perhaps not so much actually in the Rhineland where we've been this week, but certainly on, you know, we've been further east. I can't shake that moment where you go, oh, bless, look at them with their rudimentary blah. And then 10 minutes later, I'm sat at the back thinking, fuck me, I can't say that. 10 minutes later, I'm sat at the back thinking, wow, that is impressive. Do you know what I mean? Do you know what I mean? The kind of British thing of, yeah, we have all this money, and aren't we amazing? And I don't know about you, but I get the sense that we probably do deserve that kind of global reputation in research. Mm-hmm. Not sure we deserve it on the kind of teaching side.
I agree. And I wonder to what extent, by students going on Erasmus, or more and more students going on Erasmus, they can like spearhead the, you know, advancements in teaching and learning, you know, just jumping off of Abby's point there. But if more students are going to new countries, experiencing new forms of assessment, new forms of teaching and learning, and new ways of being a student, when they come back, they have a whole plethora of knowledge to be able to critique, identify, you know, and work out what teaching and learning works best for them. Plus, they've done a pass-fail year for most, which, you know, is low stakes and is able to kind of settle into that. They'll be able to critique in such a more kind of confident way. And I used to say this when I used to do course rep training years ago, that it was really hard to train these reps to identify good and bad practice, because they only know one university experience. Those that go in Erasmus will have, you know, another one and another culture. The other thing, just to jump off of Gary's point, you know, the return is really important. We've not been in Erasmus since 2020. The return is also the challenge, because all of those Erasmus-based roles at universities have gone, and universities are making efficiencies and cuts, and any more of, you know, those extra roles will not be there. The funding for those roles will be limited. And for students to make huge decisions, and particularly students from, you know, first-generation students that might never have even left the country, that really want to take hold of this opportunity, they need support and guidance on everything from which country will accept me and my values and my beliefs and you know, and characteristics, to, you know, where am I going to be able to study best? And they need staff support to be able to do that effectively. Currently, there is not enough staff in UK universities to be able to support that. And everywhere we visited on this trip, it takes them all of 5 minutes when we talk about international students to talk about their Erasmus office. We're going to have to set all those back up again with a lot of time, with a lot of speed, and not with a lot of money. So there's, you know, I'm sorry to be the pessimist in the room, but there we go.
But that is interesting, isn't it, Gary, right? Because, you know, every university in the world's got an international office. You know, when kind of planning the trips, right, you contact the international office. But, you know, the truth is, a lot of them, these are people that, you know, receive visitors and generally are into internationalism and so on. You know, if I think of an international office in the UK, I'm thinking about people who are very, very hard marketing, or handling large numbers of agents. You know, it's a different beast then.
Yeah, but I think that we know from a slight tangent of the conversation that there's a real challenge for governing bodies at the moment to think about sustainable finances. You know, that's one of Edward Peck's challenge and one of the focuses of the OFS strategy. It's certainly lots of governing bodies I know across the country engaging with some of the lessons from Dundee. And one of the lessons, you need to invest in the future. Like, you can't just be about survival, as tempting and as important is that as that is at the moment. So I think a wise vice chancellor is thinking about what will I differentiate this to my students in 5 years, in 10 years time. And this feels like one of the few, I don't want to call it a life belt, but maybe one of the few exciting opportunities that we can, let's say, as much as we're going to do hell, expect. So as we take that fund, that it will not be a small opportunity cost. Like, people will need to find that resource from somewhere. And there will be some universities I absolutely expect who will not be able to take up the Erasmus opportunity because they literally cannot do it. I suppose we need to be thinking about what academic colleagues who may have some capacity, you know, this might be part of their development at times, might be program development time, might be able to lend to corporate relationships. Certainly, I think there's an absolute opportunity for some of the youth work threads that exist within the Erasmus program for student unions to be part of that, because I think it's really easy to go, if it isn't my department that does it, it can't be done. I don't think that's true. I think new and exciting ways of doing it have got to be delivered. We know there's some partnership opportunities that perhaps might be available for universities if they're able to see this as actually developmental and not a competitive element. And could there be city or regional partnerships that accelerate some of these? I think we've got to think about this as a long-term opportunity. So it might require short-term prioritization of resource.
Yeah. I guess the other thing, Abby, is, right, I remember years ago, I was sat in a meeting when I worked at UEA that was discussing some of this, and it was mainly about quality assuring the individual credit partnerships, right? And I had the temerity to sit in the corner and say, what happens when a student needs to make a complaint, or a student is sexually harassed, or a student needs support? Have we quality assured what's on offer at the other end? And everyone stared at the floor for about 30 seconds, and then the chair said, well, we're going to have to take that offline. And that was the usual signal that nobody had thought about it but didn't want to admit it in the room, right? You know, the truth, I think, is whilst we, you know, we have seen some really impressive things, a lot of the systems around Europe are a lot more hands-off, I guess, in terms of responsibility for students, aren't they?
I mean, it's interesting. It's something I wish I'd asked a bit more about at some of the institutions. There was one, we actually met one of the psychologists on site, and she was really fabulous. And I think it seems to be that those for whom are really experienced in kind of having an international office, it's really established, and that was the case, that they seem to be quite across that. And for those for whom it is a nice add-on, there's perhaps more less of that. And I think when we think of students, we often just go, right, well, is there going to be, if it's English students, is there going to be people who can speak English, who they can play tennis with, and who will take them to a bar and drink beer with them, and, you know, have they got somewhere to live? But I don't know. I mean, I was encouraged by the mental health provision, particularly that they were speaking about. But it's interesting you say that, because we didn't really touch on what it would be like if you were someone coming in on those sort of more temporary schemes. And, you know, actually within the university at the moment, there are interesting discussions about how do you provide support for students who are not on your central site, and actually how are they not just in a vacuum of rights or support? And I think that I am concerned, it seems to be something that when it seems to be students' unions who are bringing it up, and I'm concerned that it should be the universities who are bringing it up. So, I mean, it's difficult to say, because it is so dependent on the institutions who end up, you know, being part of the scheme and that English students go to. But I guess maybe it would be interesting for UK universities to coordinate with their unions, because actually we're quite good at that sort of thing and holding places to account, and that might be the way to go. But, you know, when we forget about that, bad things do happen, and there could be nothing worse than, you know, a student death or students in real crisis in another country where you can't access them. And I think that could easily, when everything's all shiny and lovely, be forgotten about. So I think, you know, we've had a lot of discussions around mental health in the sector recently, and I think that's really important. And we could get too lost in the, we're all just going to have a Belgian beer and it's going to be lovely. It can be isolating. So one would hope that that will be part of the strategy.
But that wheels us round to student unions briefly, Mac. You know, the truth is, quite often we meet, you know, the board of the student union, and one of them is the Erasmus officer. You know, they take mobility very seriously. And, you know, they will, you know, effectively be really, they'll be running the ESN, right? The Erasmus Student Network, even though technically it'll be separate and so on. Now, there is an agenda, isn't there, for student unions, both in terms of that kind of quality assurance thing, the kind of wider student experience quality assurance thing, but also about promoting mobility and getting the Erasmus Student Networks back up and running, and just making sure that, you know, this all works.
Yeah. Well, everywhere we
we visited in the past week, there has been a sense of these Erasmus officers or these Erasmus student networks, their student associations, whatever they might be, play a key role in welcoming those students onto campus and making them feel as welcome as an international student, as a home student, and making that experience as fun as and exciting as it can be. Student unions in the UK need to be following suit and making sure that there is a point of contact so that, you know, that student union feels like a home away from home for when they're there too. It can't just be one-ended. Otherwise, you know, we're all going to be going to Europe and no one's going to be coming to us. And the value of having more European students on our campus and learning from them, from everything from a quality assurance point of view to culture and, you know, the same sort of benefits of international students is well renowned, and we can only look forward to more of it.
Right, let's see who's been on the bus this week.
Hi, I'm Lexi and I'm the Union Affairs Officer at the University of Manchester Students Union. I found it really interesting how Pangaea cultivate a sense of belonging among international students through their buddy scheme, which is something we're piloting at Manchester. More broadly, one of my key takeaways is the similarity in the challenges students face and how these challenges transcend borders and physical boundaries. Every single organisation we visit have said the three biggest challenges facing their students are rising tuition fees, unaffordable accommodation, and the increasing inability of their students to meet their own basic needs. This absolutely correlates with what we know to be true at Manchester and what we also see more broadly across the HE sector. We need to make a concerted, collaborative effort to combat this and make students' lives better in the UK, in Europe, and definitely worldwide.
Hello, I'm Joe, the Union President at Christchurch Students' Union.
And I'm Emma, the President of Academic Life. One thing we found really interesting this week is the University Library at Luxembourg. We liked the way they use their infrastructure to accommodate different studying needs of different students.
We think it was great how they integrated the old steel factory into their different architecture that is built to accommodate different types of learning. We think maybe the UK government should steal some of their ideas.
Now, next up, Abby, a private members bill on higher education. This doesn't happen very often. A private members bill has emerged this week. Tell us more.
Well, this is very topical, Jim, because I was sat on our very bus and I received an email about this private members bill. I don't remember where we were going. I think we were going out of Switzerland.
Or in, or around.
Somewhere around there. So a group of Labour MPs is calling for maintenance loans in England to be paid monthly rather than in the three-termly kind of big chunky sums, bringing the system in line with Scotland, which I didn't realise. So I can say as a student, student finance payments were always at the most inconvenient times. They usually come about a week after you're already there, so you're already in your overdraft. You paid rent about 3 months prior, and for a lot of students, if you don't have savings, it can be really crunchy. So the bill proposed by York Outer MP Luke Charters, good name, and supported by the NUS and dozens of regional student unions, such as our own, would also give students their first payment in advance of term starting so they can pay rent deposits and buy supplies. Very important. Charters told Sky News that many students are maxing their overdrafts and credit cards. I can relate to that because they struggle to manage their budgets, and with working class students who cannot rely on parental support are particularly affected. I've known a lot of students for whom that's been really difficult. The bill comes amid growing concerns within Labour about the party's offering to young people, with around 60 MPs reporting in a WhatsApp group discussing how to improve higher education policy. The Greens came second in several major university cities at the general election, and a YouGov poll last July showed that nearly half of 18 to 24 year olds were open to voting for them.
Well, Mac, this is fascinating, and 60 Labour MPs are talking about improving Labour's offer on universities and students. The best they can come up with is taking an inadequate maintenance loan and slicing it up a bit.
Get me in this WhatsApp chat right now. Oh my goodness me, I would love to be a fly on the wall.
Memes in there.
I will be sending some top quality banter in there. I am really surprised to find that 60 MPs are talking about higher education students on WhatsApp. I'll be honest with you, I feel like over the summer when we were on every single Avanti West Coast train there was, that we were selling students a bit of a lie, Jim, when we were training student officers, because we were telling them about the higher education white paper on its way. Speak to your MP, make sure they understand the intricacies of the student experience, that you're working two-thirds of your time, two-thirds of students are working, that you're struggling about food, you're struggling with different forms of assessment, disability adjustments aren't being made, and so on and so forth. We were begging them to have those conversations, and we know that they were. And then the white paper came, and it seemed like it was just trying to solve the government's industrial strategy aims rather than try and solve higher education and students' realities. However, to hear that they've got 60 MPs chatting away in this WhatsApp group, and the best they can come up with is changing the timing of the loan, it's like adding a bit more salt to the pot rather than like starting from scratch. Throw the pot away, for goodness sake. The problem with the maintenance loan, and I nearly hit my head against the window of the bus, but I didn't want to cause a problem, was that that. It's the amount that's the problem. And specifically, it's the threshold. And the £25,000 household parental income threshold has been there since 2007. We have visited institutions on this trip that were only formed after 2007. The threshold is the problem. And also, the key problem right now is every time they keep announcing an increase in the maximum amount, as if we should, you know, clap our hands and go, fantastic, thank you very much, Bridget, they keep miscalculating what the projection inflation numbers are. And that compounding mistake year on year on year, that means that someone hasn't been rising with inflation correctly for so long. So it's not only not enough, it's not been increasing with inflation. Not enough people are getting it. But the problem is the timing.
You know, I understand everything Meg has said, yeah, obviously, Gary, but, you know, gift horse in the mouth and all that, you know, this is a good place to start, isn't it? You know, clearly this private members bill isn't going to pass, but, you know, probably a piece of higher education legislation coming at some point. You know, maybe this is the thin end of a wedge.
I love my job and my boss is in the room. But I do think one of the brilliant things is working student leaders who are uncompromising in their ambitions and academics who are uncompromising in their perceptionism. And sometimes I am just a centrist dad who's a bit of a manager. And I just think this is how things get done. It is incrementalism all the way, Jim. It's the best we can hope for these days. And you're right. I think in terms of the sausage making of the principle and the mechanics of this, fair play to Lou Charles, the MP, as I've said, for York Outer, you know, two universities, one large FE college. He's coordinated something which is signalling an intent for broader legislation. The MPs who have signed up for this, in my view, the WhatsApp group, are signalling an intent to be taken seriously in the negotiations on that legislation. Because, as Abby said, they are concerned about the threat from the left as well as from the right. They're mindful about promised future legislation around votes for 16-year-olds, and they're thinking about what that means. I think the mechanics of it, again, we're obviously not just talking about the principles of student support, we're talking about institutional cash flow. We're talking about the continued abysmal way in which SLC operates, because at some point, you know, the intent is great, but it's got to be delivered by the student loans company. So I expect I might get some of this money by mistake, and it is a greater likelihood.
Let's hope not.
Absolutely. But my final point, I suppose, on the mechanics of this is that in his speech, Luke Charters was emailing student unions, working with the National Union of Students, and has spoken to student representatives that representing a third of all higher education students. Now, the degree to which there is a consensus on this, therefore, that it is something which could just be done, you might think in any sensible state, this is not a matter for legislation, it's a matter for policy. Mm. Like a Secretary of State should be able to just go, can we do this? Do I need to go through primary legislation? Mm. Perhaps that might even be possible. I mean, I'm not an expert on the mechanics of the relevant legislation, but it feels like this is a start of an opportunity for both institutions, students, the general public, to start lobbying on higher education legislation. From the Johnson years all through whoever followed him, forget her name, the act of lobbying is something that perhaps we've lost. Mm. Like for many years, nobody listened to us. We've had a year of a government that was getting that together after a long spell of opposition. The negotiation on evidence-informed policy, trade-offs, opportunity, electoral benefit, maybe the dark arts of ACT, and actually us being able to rely upon organisations like NUS working with progressive MPs like Lou Charters, maybe there's a sign of hope in that. Mm.
I'll tell you what, do you think about this, Abby, right? You know, in the Renters' Rights Act, as of May the 1st, right, you can't pay a term or a year's rent up front. And, you know, clearly, lots of students don't do that for really good reasons, but some do. You know, they get their loan in those three chunks and they pay that term's rent. And, you know, if suddenly they're not allowed to do that, there is a real danger that, you know, they sort of run out of money at the end of every semester. So the thing I can't believe is that the bit of the government that was talking about that in one department wasn't automatically saying to the Department for Education, well, we're going to need to think about student loan repayments. You know, this feels like a lack of joined up government and that Luke Charters is trying to join.
I mean, do you know what's interesting is that I remember the issue that this Prime Minister was trying to address so clearly as a student, that it's very easy then to be like, brilliant, let's sort that. And you forget that there will be quite a lot of little things that will need to be sorted out. Similarly, you know, university grant payments come at a certain time and lining that up then might be a bit more complex.
But this does get us to the guarantor issue, Matt. Mm-hmm. And of course, in France, we saw a solution to the guarantor issue. You know, the government acts as guarantor if you haven't got a lot of money, thanks to student campaigning. Is that the sort of thing we now need to, you know, the whole sector needs to start looking at, given this problem that international students are going to have?
If students can't pay more than a month's rent up front, that totally sidelines all of the international students who were paying 6 months, 12 months, however much rent in advance. I'm not saying that was a good thing, but it was certainly a mechanism when they didn't have a UK-based guarantor. Now, we're going to have a situation where either those international students are going to have to look at commercial-based guarantors, which are expensive, and often those landlords will push
so expensive
towards one, which will, you know, they'll get a little cut off because of course they will, or they're going to have to, or they're not going to rent to those students, and they're going to be pushing to expensive PBSAs. So, you know, another thing to add to the list of how we're really supporting international students in the UK. The reality is, you know, great if we can follow some sort of French model where the institution or the government acts as a guarantor for those students of which have passed through UKVI and our immigration service, and according to the UKVI rules, they have enough money in their bank account to be in this country and therefore live here and therefore pay rent. We can argue about the intricacies of whether that, you know, that maintenance amount in their bank account is enough, but UKVI says it's all right. So if UKVI says it's all right, why are we then kind of subcontracting that out to a commercial guarantor to stick the rubber stamp on to a cost to the international student? Just seems bizarre to me. So absolutely, why? Well, the government haven't thought about this because they're thinking about renting in a totally different department to the department to think about students, and none of them are talking to each other.
The other thing that strikes me, Gary, is just before Christmas,
when was it?
A set of UCAS stats comes out, another rise in the percentage of students that are choosing a university that is close to home. Now, obviously, almost all of Europe, that's much more common, but also obviously, there is not the sort of, you know, dropping subjects, closing courses that we're seeing in the UK. So, you know, what is the right trade-off? Should we start to move away from being the country in Europe that has the most number of students that leaves home to go to university? Or
there's a few things in that for me, Jim. I think following on from Mac, I think we fall into the UK, the bad habit, before we go into trade-offs, I think it's worth looking at our assumptions. When we think about government as guarantor, one thing which we continue to remind ourselves is that another government department is on a devolution agenda. And actually, we've spoken before on the podcast about the local government white paper and what Steve Reed is doing, and actually the ability for mayors and combined authorities to offer policy intervention with vicar report development in the housing market is something where we as institutions, as student unions, need to have a much better dialogue with locally elected representatives. So Luke Charter should also be talking to your man from North Yorkshire, I think that's Dan Norris, about tying that together, because actually the solution in North York housing is not going to be solved in London. It's got to be solved in North York. I then think there's some conversations absolutely about people choosing to live local to home. Some of that I think has got to be tied into so many things. I mean, I've spoken before about the extent to which transport, particularly in areas like York Outer, are massively affected about how and why people can travel. You know, the Welsh higher education system is entirely dependent upon connections across North Wales, for example. It absolutely will also tie into some of the institutional rationale around campuses, around amalgamation, around mergers, because locality, of course, depends upon place. And you can only be a local student if there is something to you which is close and accessible. And I think that the policy trade-offs for me, Jim, are really going to be about the way in which institutions are tying into the white paper around locally developed skills, because again, the local government white paper and we presume the HE white paper is talking about, are there such a locally developed skills? Like, does the East Midlands need electricians in the way the South West relies upon on the magic?
It does.
So yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So we need to be talking about that sort of thing much more intelligently, because if we don't, what we'll be designing is demand where there's no supply and supply where there's no demand. Mm-hmm. And it's bad enough with one. Like, we shouldn't be having both.
The other thing that strikes me, Abby, is right. So obviously, when we're talking about maintenance loans, we're talking about giving people enough money to live on in a very, very expensive country. Mm. Right? You know, whenever we've done cost comparisons this week, you know, the people, obviously it's not as expensive as the UK.
Blah, blah, blah.
You know, people know across Europe just how expensive the UK has got. But, you know, back to Erasmus, one of the interesting things that's kind of buried in Erasmus that I don't think lots of people know about is the Discovery U Pass. As part of it all, a huge number of people, young people every year, get almost free rail travel as part of the Erasmus experience.
Oh, love it.
Even if you ignore the Erasmus bit of that, you know, where were we the other day? We were in Germany where all students can get, you know, public transport, buses, rail, you know, the whole thing for, I think it was, you know, €25 a month or something, yeah. You know. Yeah. And that's another government department that needs to do some joined up work, doesn't it?
Yeah.
In terms of getting the cost of being a student down rather than just continually loaning them more money.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I feel like public transport is the bane of many students' unions because it's one of the most it's very tangible. It's a very everyday issue, but it's actually really, really hard to influence change on it because, you know, you have the complexities of a million different bus companies operating in your area. You've got, you know, we've got some nationalised rail now, but that doesn't seem to be massively touching it. We've then got some privatised. We've got, it's really difficult.
Well, lots of students live in one local authority area.
Well, exactly. And they'll go to another. And, you know, we also have universities who are taking on far more students than they can fit on their campuses. So they're then pushing them out to exterior cities. So then they're commuting and then your trains aren't operating. They're expensive. You know, we had a student came in who needed to go to Newcastle for something specific and couldn't afford the train fare. You know, I would love a situation where students were treated as an exceptional, you know, category when it comes to transport, because actually it would also, you know, I think particularly when, as students' unions, we're trying to address many things. One is, you know, the very much the kind of very material cost, and the other is like student belonging and isolation. And I think that a lot of students, particularly in Durham, who live a bit further out, actually, if we could say, you know, buses are free or they are much, much cheaper. We've had students come in who say, you know, I had to live further out because our housing is so expensive. But as a woman, I feel unsafe walking back at night an hour to my student flat. And so I'm having to get Ubers, which cost me £6 or £7 because the buses aren't running. Or if they are, you know, actually going back and forward on a bus just is, it is expensive. It gets expensive very fast. And actually, we've been pondering, how do you tackle that? And there isn't an easy answer to that. So actually, from, I'd love government, regional or central, to have a really good think about that, because actually it's not like we don't do it for pensioners. So if there are communities that we decide
triple locked,
if we decide there are communities that are important enough, that their social inclusion is important enough, that we provide them the means to do that, that would be great. And also it would put a little bit less pressure on the government to have to keep slapping 50 quid on the maintenance owed every single time. Actually, if we could say there was a more holistic picture, then maybe as a higher education sector, we'd be a little bit more forgiving. But unfortunately, it's so expensive in every other sense. Also, I love public transport, so it'd be great.
I mean, obviously, Matt, shout out for that study we've been banging on about for a couple of months about in Dublin, where women students that had a more than 45-minute commute had a massive drop in, you know, their well-being scores. You know, quite often we think, you know, you and I led on the commuter student series. Quite often we think about commuter students in quite complex academic terms, but, you know, one substantial piece of research suggests it's the commute and how unsafe and difficult that is. And when we've got students now, often who are working substantial hours, not in city centres because of the collapse in retail and hospitality jobs, working, you know, often further out in other places, you've got this kind of triangle, haven't you, of public transport where, you know, you've got campus in one place, you've got where students live in another and where they work in another. And not only can that be quite unsafe, it can also cost a fortune.
Yeah, it's probably comprising three different modes of public transport and three different compounding costs, all of which don't have a single student ticket or discount available at all. And Happy's right, the pensioners get there. I've got some older friends, that sounds really odd, doesn't it? Some friends of a particular age who are very much looking forward to their...
Well, crucially, of course, the pensioners get their freedom pass.
Yes.
And what that indicates is that other people who can't afford it have less freedom. Right, let's see who else has been on the bus this week.
My name's Robin Brown and I am the Royal Agricultural University Students Union president. My favourite part of the trip has been getting to meet the guys at the University of St Gallen. It's been really interesting to understand the Swiss education system, how they put a high GDP per capita to good use, how important university life is to Swiss people and to Swiss students, and understanding how important and how cool the student parliament is as a concept for most Swiss universities, giving students a direct voice by electing officials who attend big meetings, and how the relationship between the president and the executive and the parliament, which is just, it's like nothing anywhere else in the world, and it was incredibly cool. So thank you so much to the guys at St Gallen for that.
Hi there, my name is Muhammad Barikullah. I'm the vice president for undergraduate education at the University of Westminster Student Union. So while we're going through a lot of European countries throughout our wonky trip this week, the most interesting and fascinating things that I have seen will be, actually it's today's day, while we visited STAN. So STAN is like the Students' Union for the University of Antwerp, where we met lovely people. And the two most interesting ideas that I found absolutely fascinating and would love to import back to the UK, especially in my university. One would be their initiative of giving unique locations for students to study, like friendly cafes and stuff like that, because it helps students to find their own environment and find their vibe to study. for, you know, for the Generation Z, the vibe is a very important thing. And the other one would be the fact that they're doing a lot around international students, and they have built an entire floor just for international students. So how easy it is for somebody coming from a country, let's say Pakistan, India, or Luxembourg, some other country than Belgium, to come in and find their own people on that international students floor. So that is absolutely amazing.
My name is Gemma Veal from Exeter Students Guild, and I am the Society's and Employability Officer for this year. Being on this trip with Wonky and visiting many European universities has been really enlightening on how they help to shape the student experience. A lot of these universities have talked about loneliness as something that their students face, and that is the same in the UK. However, at my student union, we talk a lot about belonging and how there is a cost of belonging crisis in the UK and in Exeter, and how we are trying to combat that through our clubs and societies, our communities. However, framing it through the lens of loneliness and seeing what these other universities do, such as buddy systems and community cafes and community events within accommodations, really seems to make it hit home more, calling it loneliness. So that is something I'm going to be taking back to my student union and looking at a loneliness initiative.
Hi, I'm Becca, the Student Communities Officer at the University of Lincoln Students Union. What I have found interesting about this week has been the common theme raised at the majority of institutions we have visited. The concerns for international fees has been eye-opening, as this is something rarely protested at institutions in the UK. Seeing home and international students rally together against the increase is something I have not experienced back home, but is something I think the UK needs to address. One big takeaway from this experience has been the significant difference between the amount charged to those studying in Europe and the UK, which concerns me given the barriers regarding visas already in place for international students.
Now, finally, this week, we've been on this bus tour, Gary. Why?
Well, that
why,
was
Gary? Question. Why?
The question.
Justify it.
And I've written on the site before that I know why I'm on the bus, and I think, true most people, that we believe in the value that education is about interaction. You learn from people.
Mm-hmm.
And like, we could Google the transport system in Luxembourg or, you know, view brilliant buildings online. But the value of sitting down with people and asking to explore the context, the aspirations, the hopes, is incredibly powerful. Now, many of our colleagues in universities, their whole methodology is based on this. Mm-hmm. And it would be really weird if students occasionally didn't do things for themselves. That's really the lesson why we're here. So I think in Europe, the way in which higher education is organised, because of where it's come from, is different. One thing that I certainly reflect on is how many new institutions, new countries, places that have roots in the 13th century but had to reinvent themselves in the post-war period have chosen to fund, to structure, to deliver education. And that sort of inspiration isn't only the domain of vice-chancellors or registrars. It's also important as student leaders see that. Mm-hmm. We've spoken on this podcast today, but previously, that there's massive value in the soft exchange. You know, in the absence of Erasmus, we got on a bus and went to places so we could learn in a cold week in January. There is absolutely a reason we're here to take things back. You know, we really recognise that this is not a copy and paste job. We can't copy public transport that's free in Luxembourg and move it to the northeast of England. But what we can do is think about why that's important, the value it creates, and persuade people that this is something they should invest in. That's the sort of thing that you can only learn really by experiencing it. This is, I think, the 8th, maybe the 9th trip that's been done. We've been on this trip to Germany, Switzerland, France, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, and Belgium. And each one has had common routes, but different eccentricities and different quirks, which has been fantastic. When we get back to the UK, we will share that. You know, some of our reflections are going to come up right now. But this is, I think, one of the most wonderful and important things that student unions do. And it's great to be able to share that through the podcast with listeners.
Mm. Now, Abby, obviously, one of the things that happens is you sort of kind of try and get your bearings, don't you? It's all, look, that's a...
All the time.
You know, no, you know what I mean? They also have desks. Oh, look, they also have Windows.
Yeah.
Windows 95, not Windows 95. You know, there's a Windows PCs. Right? Oh, look, there's a... Looks like a student shop or a welfare center or whatever. But if you go one step back, right, what is your sort of general sense of the sort of relationship between students and universities and between students and students? You know, do you detect wider things going on?
Yeah. I do. It's really interesting because we've had talks from unions or union adjacent organisations and also from university staff. And actually, I kind of thought we'd see what I experience, but just they'd be European. And I don't think that that's true. I think that actually, you know, if our vice chancellor's this thing, I'm sure she's not. She might be, you never know. But I think is that actually we have quite a built-in working relationship that I think kind of, I feel like as a union, we're able to be some, you know, autonomous, but also embedded in university decision making. It's not perfect, but I think what they seemed much more separate to me. So it was if you were a student within and you were speaking on behalf of the university, you were very much speaking on behalf of the university and you did their processes and you weren't too critical of that. You just kind of did the system. You went through it, you know, you were a rep or whatever they asked and you did it within that. And then if you were a union, I think they were much more intent on their own independence. And actually, they were more of a protest group or a pressure group in a lot of cases, which I found really fascinating. And I think there's pros and cons to that because I really liked that it felt a little bit more bottom-up power. I think students maybe seized their power a bit more than we tend to do. A lot of them were current students, which I found really interesting because actually we have sabbatical officers and with that comes a slightly strange, it's a strange role. It's amazing, but it is strange because you're not technically a student anymore, but you're speaking for students. And I think there was something around if you were writing an essay at 10 p.m. at night and at 11, you're writing your notes to, you know, do a protest or to try and speak to university staff. There is something a bit more gritty about that, which I kind of appreciated. Yeah, it was really fascinating. It was really hard to pin down what was different, but I think there's definitely perhaps a stronger sense that it is by students for students. There were less union staff than maybe we're used to. And then the universities were maybe a little bit more intent on separation. I don't think that there are always is a good working relationship between students, unions and universities in the UK, but I think perhaps there's maybe an acknowledgement that we slightly need each other. And I don't know if there was that so much, which was interesting.
Yes. I mean, the nature of that kind of corporate relationship is obviously distinct. But the other thing that really struck me last night, Mac, was, so we were in a student association building, mm-hmm. and lots of student associations in this particular city of Maastricht. And, you know, they were talking to, you know, the person who runs the bar was talking to us about changing barrels. And then, the person who puts on social events was, you know, doing those things. And of course, they were talking about their job. But one of the things I was sat at the back doing was totting up the number of people mm-hmm. who are taking a semester out at mm-hmm. that university, mm-hmm. who are doing things, but who are doing something else, which is worrying about other students. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I sometimes think in the UK is that we have quite sophisticated, quite strong, you know, kind of corporate relationships where we're good at giving people services. Mm-hmm. But actually, if I added up the number of students, funnily enough, not so much at Durham, given some of the other structures that exist. If I look at lots of universities, I ask myself, how many students think that they're responsible for the kind of well-being and success of other students? It doesn't feel like anywhere near as many.
No, I think her name was Celia that we spoke to last night. I was on her own, bless her. And the first thing she said, you know, we said, well, why are you doing all of this? And she was part of something called Scope, which was a study organisation. They were about trying to support students academically to enhance their soft skills, improve their career opportunities, giving them an opportunity to connect with other universities and also do the social stuff, you know, the skiing trips and the drinking and so on. And they said that they've probably got about 100 board members. They've got so many students, as you say, Jim, in lots of different pies, doing loads of different things, developing all of these soft skills. And there's two really important things there. One is that they do it, their motivation. And I wrote down exactly what Celia said was, this was the way that she found friends and made best friends through it. And she wants to be able to provide that experience for others. And there is a real strong sense that somebody did this for me and I want to do it for them. And I want to kind of give back. And half the time it's because somebody else they'd met through it has suggested that they should run for that leadership position. And there is a myriad of positions which they can do. It's, you know, not, there's not only one course rep for the 100 students. There's loads and loads of opportunities. The other thing which was fascinating about the motivation bit is we stuff with a bit of an engagement crisis in the UK right now where we're frustrated that not enough students are attending lectures and not enough students are doing volunteering roles or doing extracurricular stuff. And that's affecting the job market, that they're less employable because they're not doing as much stuff. Various reasons for that. It's mainly part-time work and confidence. But the reasons why they get involved is because they're given credits for this work and they're given the opportunity to take those soft skills and to manifest them into credits as part of their course. A lot of the time, it's even mandatory. And they're, you know, we're taking the credits off of the academics one by one and giving them and the ability to then have, you know, more employable skills, whether that is leadership, whether that is finance, whether that is, you know, social networking and event planning, whatever it might be. These people care about doing something for other students because they'd handed them to them and they get their core benefit of freeing up their time by able to get an academic credit for it if they're not paid, for example.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that is very interesting, isn't it, Gary? Because, you know, every degree program I've looked at this week, either through a major minor system or the way the, you know, Bologna compliance and ECTS credits work and so on, I have really struggled to find a student studying chemistry or history or whatever, where all the credit is in chemistry or history or whatever. You know, it's often interdisciplinary. Mm-hmm. Often there's academic credit for the kind of induction and key skills stuff that we wedge into academic programs, you know, ham-fistedly. Why is it that academic staff in a particular subject own all of the academic credit in the English system? Is it just because no one feels ready to move away from it? Because, you know, certainly the evidence suggests in the regret research a couple of years ago that students would love this to be more of an opportunity to choose their own adventure.
Yeah. Well, I think
that goes back to my point, Jim, that I'm really fascinated by the history of these places, because actually, you know, that's the only place upon which the present has been built. And the fact that within the UK, regardless of the sort of institution you are, there perhaps have been an understanding, I think we see this sometimes said explicitly, actually, that universities are places of academics. You know, senates are the parliaments of universities, and occasionally some teenagers might also be present. They're occasionally noisy.
But sometimes
that. And there are some house elves that stack the shelves and do the catering and who have no rights. But the people who run this university, obviously, you know, I think we might, with respect to some of our colleagues in trade unions, say we are the university, by which we mean academics. I think what we're seeing in Europe much more is that is a really silly way to view a university. Of course it is constructed of its students and of its career staff and who collectively create the campus. Now, if you have the view that this is a collective endeavour, people have freedom and rights within that. And actually students are able to say, this is my education which you are providing. And I'm a spectator, a professor and a professional. I'm here to learn from and with you. But actually, I'm not a supplicant. The thought that in the UK, a student might go, I don't want to do the course you've designed. I'd like to design my own. It's notable that some universities have the equivalent of an open degree. You know, the Open University obviously does that very well, actually. Possibly because it doesn't have this legacy of nonsense. But I think about places like Sunderland has a great constructed degree cobbled together. But the parameters are really tightly set by academics. There's probably some, you know, this is just a hypothesis informed by reading and also by kids. I think to some extent that would be in. Sorry, there's a dog in the room. I think to some extent that the parameters of that will mean that we're unable to think about being ambitious about students constructing the university because a chemist student has to negotiate with chemistry lecturers, not with university. I think there is a degree to which, if I put myself in the shoes of some academics, you've got to be producing graduates that hit the employability metrics, that hit the progression and mobility metrics, and it's really hard to do that if you're doing. The reason this chemist isn't earning really high salaries as a chemist is they thought that dance would be a great thing to add. So I think we've designed some perverse incentives in that prevent us having that degree of flexibility. But we should look at the examples when it does exist, because it can exist. Yeah. As possible people, I think we've got to go, why doesn't it?
But that's it. I mean, look, Abby, one of my reflections, and I have had this reflection before on these trips, but one of my reflections this week was that the moment I fell off my chair, we were in Zurich when...
That's where you went, literally.
When they were talking about what they called focus groups, and they didn't mean focus groups, they meant an access and participation initiative. You know, suddenly they were talking about students that don't feel very confident, that perhaps have got imposter syndrome, where students just kind of randomly inside an association spotted this and decided to intervene to do something about it, and specifically asked academic staff to get involved, you know, led by students. I sometimes get a sense in the UK that we've kind of convinced ourselves that students won't do anything, and so we must do it all for them, or it will not be done. And there are good reasons for that economically and in terms of their time and so on. But do we need to be more ambitious about what we think students can do for the university and for each other?
Yeah, I really do think so. I mean, something that was interesting as a student was to see the sort of feedback people gave for modules that they were on. And often it was around, you know, it feels very one-sided when I get feedback back for an essay or an exam that I spent, you know, weeks writing. You get a couple lines, you might get a 5-minute office hours, 10 minutes if you're lucky. And actually, people who wanted to have a real investment in their degree and were looking to be the best students they could possibly be, those aren't students who are passive or detached. Those are students who, if you gave them the opportunity to have a little bit more say, I think would take it. I think that I'm often skeptical when we say, you know, it's this generation of students in some form that aren't going to engage when we put events on or aren't going to take positions up, whatever. Because I think if it is doing what they want, they will do it. And students want to have the most holistic, interesting degree they possibly can, because it's it's great for one and good for your sense of self, but also for the job market. And I wish sometimes, you know, it's interesting at Durham because, you know, we're a very competitive university. We're a lot of students who come at, you know, immensely smart, but sometimes it feels like staff or university execs don't treat their students as if they are as smart as they are training them to be. So we're claiming in our league tables that we have some of the smartest students in the country.
Well, we couldn't possibly let them.
But my gosh, we can't put them in a focus group. Like, I think it's interesting because sometimes you hear the thing, students don't know what they want. I've heard that a lot, actually. And actually, I think that's wrong, because if they really are that thick, we really shouldn't be in the position that we are in the league tables. Mm. And our academic staff isn't that good. So I just, you know, I'm really desperate for people to treat them as we externally say that they are. And also, you know, a lot of these students have been in school parliaments. They were people who took up positions. They were students who were proactive. You know, to go to university is a massive thing. We have a lot of universities in this country, but to go through the UCAS system, to write your personal statement, to have the courage to say, I think I'm smart enough that I can do a degree. You've got some like spunk there that can absolutely be put into developing degrees that are more interesting, more dynamic, and also helping university staff out. The university staff I've met in my department, I did politics and sociology, who really were interested in what students had to say, had the best modules by far, yeah, because they actually sat down and wanted to know and wanted to understand. And in the case of Zurich and stuff, you know, they were talking about, you know, how do we help students who are falling behind? I think in the UK, we tend to go, oh, well, if the office hours aren't doing it, then, oh no. And actually, do you know, that's not really how we treat people in the rest of the school system.
Yeah.
And then we get to degrees and we just go, look, if you're not, maybe you're just not sharp enough. And I don't think that that's fair, because actually the transition to a degree is such a different style of learning. It ends up being peer-to-peer support, which is great, but I'd love it if it was a bit, there was more dialogue. I think that would be great. And the lecturers who do dialogue, it's cracker. So they should do it.
But that is fascinating, isn't it, Matt? Because, you know, I mean, so many, again this week, almost everywhere we've been, very few people present as and talk about individuals. You know, there aren't many individual reps or individual heroes or individual people. We're just constantly bombarded by associations. We've got a group for this, an association for that, and so on. And, you know, I mean, it clearly is the case in a lot of UK universities that in some subject areas, every student is on their own. Yeah. And it's very, very hard, isn't it, in Europe to find a bit of a university where there isn't an association and therefore a bit of scaffolding around all of that activity, a bit of representation, a bit of coordination, a bit of a welcome party, a bit of a, yeah, you know, they all feel more personal, they're all cozier. They all feel cozier, even though some of the universities you've been to have got 60,000 students in them.
Mm. Everywhere we've been over the past week, somebody has mentioned the word loneliness, and they have all talked about every single project, initiative, association that they run. The aim is for people to make friends and for them to get to know people. There was a project that we heard about within the first 30 minutes of being in St. Gallen that said, we run this like induction activity where students get put into a group of 20. They've got a random case study to do. If they win, they go on a skiing trip. But for the other 71 students, do you know what? They know at least 20 people when they start their course. And we didn't need to interrogate why that was a good thing. We knew why that was a good thing. But for some reason, when it comes to having in-depth conversations with, you know, senior university leaders, it feels like there needs to be a big business case as to why students having friends on their course is a good thing. And all of the research tells you that their mental health improves, that their attainment improves, that they feel like they belong, they're more satisfied with student services, and so on and so on, which hits about 90% of university KPIs just by accident. And with all of these different projects and initiatives, whether it's an association, whether it is, you know, we'll talk about it later with the Agores, which was like these student solidarity supermarkets, they're all run by students. They have trust in students that they can run those projects, and they're all aimed at reducing loneliness. And the core part of that trust is from the university and from institutions and charities that students can run those things, but also from the students that those projects and services are good and meant for them. I think, Abby, you asked this question when we were at the solidarity supermarket about the way that in which students can access it is they fill in a form, it identifies whether they are in the positive or negative credit scores to whether they can access that space. And you asked, you know, is that not inaccessible? Will students like not fill in that form because, you know, they've got to give some sort of indication of how much money they've got and whether they'll be eligible? And they said, well, not really, actually. Like, we trust them to put in the correct figure. We don't ask for their bank statements. We don't ask for a clinical check on every single loan they've ever taken out. We trust them to put the right figure in, and they trust us to deliver it. And that culture of trust and anti-loneliness projects has been, you know, I'm exhausted of how much I see it because it's that good.
Yeah. Now, before we wrap up, Gary, just give us a couple of things that you were like, ooh.
Ooh, yeah. Like, yeah, let's mention now, the solid drive supermarket was great. I think
we were in Rouse at this point.
Yeah, we were in France, Mulhouse, as I've been saying it, always. Yeah. And it's a long established historical association supported by state governments in France of cheap food, basically. Mm-hmm. Max just made a point about credit history and so forth. The reason it was a way for me, I suppose, is that we had received a presentation where it was described to us, and I was expecting, I don't know why, is the word solidarity supermarket, I was expecting something like a Netto, you know, shiny shelves and lights and fridges and that sort of stuff. And actually, it was really homespun. I don't want to play it down, but it was like, oh, so people can do things. And actually, in the sense of like, what you need is some shelves.
Yeah.
What you don't need is a shop fitting arrangement and a capital plan.
And three working groups.
And three working groups. Yeah. You need a room with some shelves.
Yeah.
Perhaps a fridge.
Some
pasta. And you can crack on. And I think the wow for me was how essential to social infrastructure, something which was so utterly, frankly, ugly, but important, because shops aren't meant to be pretty. They're meant to feed people. And it really worked. And I think that it was just troubling. So I think our assumption about the way students will want to behave, I think, in the UK is that everything needs to look like an airport.
Yeah.
In that if you come to a campus and it's homespun, somebody go, I'd rather go to unnamed London University. And actually, shops need to feed people. Libraries need to have books. Mm. And most people are okay with things that are okay. And that was just a reminder of, oh, yeah, we just do some stuff.
I mean, I thought that was very cool. I was going to say, I mean, it's been really interesting because when we started, someone said, oh, what's the learning going to be? And I was like, don't make me think about that, because I am not going to be able to apply any of this to my concrete building and it's going to be very depressing. But actually, one of the places that we went to today, I think similarly to what Gary said, a lot of student unions look like an airport, and that upsets me. But we think that that's the way to do it. And actually, I think it made me realise we've been having a real think about our building. I think a lot of students' unions are reassessing their space and how do you make students feel welcome. And it was really helpful to be in a space that felt welcoming and warm and try and analyse what was good about it, because actually it doesn't take rocket science. I think that was the similar takeaway. And we have a tendency to buy really stupidly uncomfortable chairs and not have good acoustics. And actually those two things are the key to any happy student. I think it's made me realise that students are quite simple. I was quite simple as a student. If you give me a nice sofa, it was warm and it felt kind of nice, I would have spent a lot of time there. And we're often worried about getting people in the doors and people feeling like it represents us. And I was just really inspired by that. And it's really strange because I've seen a lot of really complex, interesting, nuanced operations around, you know, the structures of democracy. And I love that stuff. I was a politics student. But the bit that's really stuck with me is like how you, the sofas that you buy or the things that you stock or the kind of lighting you have can totally fundamentally change how well students feel like they can function in space. And actually, it wouldn't take £2 million to do that. It would take a bit of just like a little bit of work. And yeah, I just thought that was really cool. And also because they're European, it's very chic. We're not going to be able to, you know, rival that chicness. But as you know, I sometimes feel like I'm a bit French, so maybe we can get somewhere. But yeah, no, I was really impressed by use of space and their ability to create places that students really want to be, because I think we could be better at that in the UK than we are.
I mean, Matt's face thing, I think, is, you know, fascinating, Matt, because so about 7 times, so I was doing bingo in my house, so many times this week someone said it's someone's home, or it's someone's home away from home, or it's someone's second home, you know, that thing. And one of the things about it is, I mean, the thing that really struck me was when we were in Luxembourg, in this astonishing camper, you know, huge building, incredibly shiny. It was like being on the set of a film.
Mm. It was.
But then behind a door that she didn't get to show us, but we've seen in photos, there's a chunk of that campus which is messy, some bean bags, probably too much blue tack on the wall. Everywhere we've been, there are some, you know, pretty corporate spaces, I guess, that must look nice on an open day if they're trying to show people around, but some also some very student spaces.
choices. Mm. You kind of have to let go at some point, don't you, and say, "That this bit's students."
Yeah.
Mm.
We talk about co-creation so much in the UK, and it's such an annoying buzzword. And when we say co-creation in the UK, we talk about, we might send them a survey, we might read the findings, we might, you know, do something based off of it. We might have one student in our working group, and we've co-created that with students. And it's like 90% of the time, it's rubbish. But, you know, similar to Luxembourg, but when we were in Mulhouse, in France, we turned up to this kind of student association, part university building, part accommodation. And there were these most incredible murals on the side of the building. There was community gardens. There was a Bluetooth outdoor grill, for goodness sake. You know,
that was cool.
It was very cool. Normally, you take a picture when we go around and we see a few posters on the wall. We go, isn't that fantastic? It's a student space. and, you know, we pat ourselves the back. Oh, we do that as well as the back home. And actually, no, we don't.
No,
we don't engage and we don't create that. Those spaces were entirely student owned and were facilitated by people that had the money and the resources so that they could do that. And it felt like their space. And speaking of space, my highlight of the trip, and I was so excited to go to Belgium today, to go to Stan, which is essentially students in Antwerp. And the very funny, I don't know, everybody found him as funny as I did, Steven, very basically said in his first sentence, he said, "We care about students and we care about Antwerp and we want to keep them as happy as possible." And I kept writing down everything he said because, you know what, it was so bloody simple but so wholesome. He said, you know, to study is to be able to experiment in life, and the basis of it's the basis of how they create their next 5 to 7 years, and students should be able to try something new, and they want student life to be bold and colourful. They did not give a monkeys about education and quality because they knew that somebody else was doing that. They were like a citywide SU that was focused on social cohesion, about students finding places to live, about students feeling a citizen of that city, of that town. I don't know whether Antwerp's a city or a town, that's my bad geography. And one of my favourite initiatives, which I was so excited to hear about, not just read about on their website in a poorly Google translated Dutch, was their Study 360 programme. And when we started speaking to the people at Stan and the students as well, they said exactly the same things that we would say in some sort of annoying community forum, that students are loud, they are noisy, they are messy, and, you know, they'll be up until 3 a.m. shouting in the streets. Same vibe, same problem there. But the difference is the way that they can work with the community, there isn't that same sort of distrust and anger, because this Study 360 programme has been on for 10 years now, and the team at Stan have been working with employers, with local organisations, so that students have a space to co-work with other students. Again, that link of building belonging and of making friends. They can go sit in IKEA, in the back of IKEA.
Love that bit.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Sit in the back of IKEA with your friends and do a study group, or in the local police station, or in, you know, another local building. And not only is that integrating them more into the community, but actually quite a funny thing was that often those employers like to do that because then they can tap them on the shoulder for a job in the future. But they were integrated into the community to the extent to which that city felt like home to them. And the people that live in Antwerp recognise those students as being citizens too. And I can't help but have sorry to be pessimistic again, but our high streets are dying and a lot of universities are making cuts and efficiencies. And, you know, there is so much space on our campus, which, you know, unfortunately might have been left redundant from staff and departments. And if we can't fix that right now, why not give it to students? And why not work closely with that local combined authority, which is about to be created, so that students can work in that disused Debenhams? Maybe not on the floor, maybe we need to like spice it up a little bit with some of this French chic furniture. But students being in the city and being closer to the community was doing bags of stuff for social cohesion, for community, and actually just making them feel like citizens, because as a city, Antwerp recognises that they want to keep students there, mm-hmm. because otherwise that wealth of knowledge comes in and goes out and the city no longer benefits. Mm-hmm. So why not work on making them feel like more like citizens rather than tourists?
So that's about it for this week. Remember to go in deep on anything we've discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to get ahead of everything going on in UKHE, just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much to Abby, Gary, Mac, everyone on the bus, Michael Salmon for making it happen behind the scenes. We'll be back next week, back in the office. Mark will be here until next week. No, Mark will be here. Until then, stay wonky.